You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here. LastWordOnSports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here. LastWordOnSoccer.com. Powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves for your official MLS, USL, and U.S. Soccer scarves. Head on over to roughneckscarves.com. It is Friday, November 1st, 2019. The U.S. Women's National Team has a new head coach, and we finally have our matchup for MLS Cup 2019. We're going to talk about all that stuff, but first, let me introduce my co-host for tonight, Rachel McCrigger. Rachel, we were lamenting before we hit the record button on the week that we've had. How are you doing tonight, my friend?
I am alive and barely functioning at all costs with a weekend of not being allowed to sleep in underway. So, let's get it.
Would you say at this very moment that you are doing better or worse than Jozy Altidore in terms of your own personal preparations for MLS Cup 2019?
I am probably doing worse. I have no preparation prepared whatsoever. But as we'll get into, I also had no idea I'd have to prepare. So, you know, maybe I'll catch up to Josie.
All right, so let's get into it. So, listeners, this past Tuesday and Wednesday were the Western and Eastern Conference Finals for the 2019 MLS Cup playoffs, respectively. We will recap these two games, starting chronologically with the Western Conference Final. This happened on Tuesday at the Bank of California Stadium in Los Angeles, California. LAFC coming off of their big, you know, season-defining franchise signature win over the LA Galaxy in El Tráfico the previous Thursday. And they went out and they played a pragmatic Seattle Sounders team, Rachel, who were in a mid-block and did a very good job of stifling one Carlos Vela, and they had a couple of chances, and it was about even if you look at the X goals, but ultimately Seattle had their stars show up when LAFC did not, and LAFC looks like a team that had played their final the previous Thursday, and the final score was 3-1 to the Sounders. Edward Atuesta gets us on the board in the 17th minute with a set-piece goal off of a foul that was sustained by one Carlos Vela. Raul Diaz responds on the counterattack in the 22nd minute, and then 4 minutes later, kind of a nothing play, and Nico Lodero dribbles through on a ball from Jovan Jones and is able to just sneak one by completely against the run of play on Tyler Miller. And then at that point, the stadium looked shocked, LAFC looked shocked, and Seattle looked like they were in complete control of the game. As we talked about last week, Rachel, we thought that this was going to be a game of who was going to be able to impose their will and their game plan on the opponent, and through the 26th minute, it was the Seattle Sounders, and then Raul Diaz on one of several long breaks that the Sounders had in the 64th minute. Not a whole lot of danger until Adama Diomande comes on in the second half for LAFC, and ultimately, you know, Brian Smetzer comes out with the win. He and the Sounders are going to a third MLS Cup in 4 years. Brian Smetzer feels bad for Bob Bradley. Bob Bradley feels bad for himself and Carlos Vela. And Rachel, I guess it's our job now to decide whether or not the Seattle Sounders deserve any credit for beating the best regular season team in the history of Major League Soccer. Rachel, where do you want to start in terms of your reactions and analysis to the madness that occurred on Tuesday evening?
Well, first off, we sat here last week and, you know, adamantly I said, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I think LAFC is going to win. And I said, and we have it on tape, that I would love to be proven wrong. And thank God I was proven wrong. That was a really, really great game. I think that, you know, they kind of went into the match as LAFC went into their match against the Galaxy, you know. Seattle had never beaten LAFC before, and they certainly hadn't done it at the Bank of California. Not many teams have come into the bank and have prevailed over LAFC. They're just so dominant at home, and for Seattle to get that win after, you know, not really the prettiest stretch of the playoffs. You know, they had that game against FC Dallas, which had a lot of head scratching around the country and especially in Seattle, thinking, you know, if these guys can't hang with a bunch of rookies, then what's going to happen at Real Salt Lake? And luckily, Seattle put on a little bit of a better performance against RSL and Nick Raimondo, and then they go into LA and just completely annihilate the competition. And I think Raul Ruiz Diaz, I mean, he really deserves all of the credit. He just turns it on another notch in the playoffs. And I think that, you know, you can say, handballs, should they have been called? Should they not have been called? To give my final ruling on that, I think if, the one instance, if you would have called it on Kim, I think that would have been a little harsh inside the box, but I think, Arriaga's handball should have been called. I'm surprised it did not go to VAR at least. That's why it's there. So I don't know. The referee, I don't know if you'd agree with this or not, was very, conservative in his calling. There really wasn't much going on there, but either way, I think that if somehow, some way, those would have been called, PKs would have been set up, I still think Ruiz Diaz would have found another goal, because he just is on another level when it comes to the playoffs, and so is Nico Lodero. And he to get him back at full health, you know, he's been kind of nursing and straggling along with a little bit of an injury, but excuse me, to get him back to full health, just those two together dynamically are so good. And then I think Seattle just has an all around good team. You know, Gustav Svensson's not a name that we say a lot, but he probably had the best performance out of everyone, maybe aside from Ruiz Diaz against LAFC. He was so good and just so dominant, and that defense was able to keep their guard around Carlos Vela, but at the same time, not just focus on him. And that was the biggest point for me going into that match was, you know, obviously guard Vela. He's done what he's done this year, scoring goals, breaking records for a reason, but you have to make sure that you guard those other players as well. I think Seattle just all around was the better team, and kudos to them for proving me wrong.
Yeah, no, a lot of good points there, Rachel. You know, I think, I don't remember who said this one on Twitter. I don't know how much of a hockey fan you are, but the commentary was effectively, this was Stanley Cup Finals level officiating in terms of calling things. There's this thing in hockey when you actually get to the playoffs that effectively the refs swallow the whistle. They're gonna let the boys be boys, and unless it's absolutely a penalty, they're not gonna decide anything that is ultimately going to change the game. And that's kind of similar to some commentary we've gotten, at least offhand or from secondary sources in the past. You know, I remember it was one of the Western Conference Finals a couple of years ago, and Bruce Arena was still with the Galaxy, between the Galaxy and the Sounders, and effectively there were hard tackles by both teams in the first leg, and members of both teams came out and said at one point that basically, like, the official said that, like, he wasn't going to send anybody off. You can say that evened out, and I don't remember what year or even who ended up winning that series, but I think it was fair to say that the head official for tonight, let me look up his name, I want to say it was Kevin Stott, it was Jair Marufo, excuse me, you know, he wasn't going to decide anything that was ultimately going to change the game. You only had two yellow cards, and it took to the 81st minute to have one. I'm not sure that there was a whole lot. You know, it was called fairly in terms of that. Obviously, LAFC didn't have any potential handballs in their own box, so you could say that there were two chances that could have gone against the Sounders, and both of them went in favor of the Sounders, so maybe they could have gone to VAR with that. But, you know, I think the referee didn't want to become the story. They didn't want the story to be about a decision that the official made, and ultimately I think that, you know, it was in that moment there was an opportunity for LAFC to do something, and ultimately they didn't do that. I don't think you can complain about the officials on that when you had most of the shots, when you had most of the ball and everything, and ultimately, you know, it took till the 64th minute for you to genuinely wake up after that first minute. And so in that, I think the Sounders were extremely pragmatic. I think they played conservatively, and they were very aware of the opponent and what they had to do to be successful. Maybe not to the level that, you know, Bobby Warshaw would have suggested, you know, with Smetzer, you know, subtweeting him in his post-game media availability of saying that, like, they flat out played scared. but they knew what the game plan was in order to beat LAFC. We had seen it in Vancouver and in Colorado, and then with Minnesota at LAFC earlier this season, and they executed it to a T. The difference was that they had two star players who, in singular moments, were going to be able to change the game. That was Raul Ruiz Diaz and Nicolas Ladero. So in a game where they negated the opponent's best advantage in Carlos Vela, we can talk about whether or not that was Vela having an off night, the system just not really working, them not really adjusting, or what Seattle actually did. It's probably a combination of both, if you ask me. And Rossi was a little bit off, and Adama Diamande had a really good chance and didn't do anything, and they weren't able to do anything in the middle. You know, I think Seattle was the pragmatic team. Seattle made LAFC play their game, and ultimately they took advantage of their chances, and in that, I think they were absolutely deserving winners of this. And so, you know, absolutely, I think Brian Smetzer and his team absolutely deserves a heck of a lot of credit in this one, and, you know, I think we're going to remember this is a massive upset, but a game in which this is the textbook definition for teams next year, assuming that LAFC doesn't completely change either their personnel or Bob Bradley doesn't leave for a bigger job outside of MLS, that this is the strategy for how you beat LAFC in 2019. Several teams did it with varying levels of success. LAFC didn't have a way around that, or wasn't able to do it within the confines of where Vela had to play and their other attacking pieces or anybody else showing up. And that's a very, very good question that Bob Bradley and company are going to have to come up with an answer to if they want to be the best team in MLS in 2020. Any other commentary we want to say just about this game, Rachel, or shall we head to the Eastern Conference?
Well, just to make a quick point, I think that, you know, Seattle, there's so much consistency and longevity. And, you know, like you said, give Schmetzer the credit where credit's due. Three finals in the last 4 years. I mean, obviously, we know Ziggy Schmidt was an amazing coach. He's a legendary coach. When he was in Seattle, couldn't quite get the team over the hump and get into the finals. So I think that what Schmetzer does is extremely underrated. Obviously, he's not going to win Coach of the Year whenever he's up against what Bob Bradley did this year, but I think that he is severely underrated in MLS.
Well said, Rachel. With that, let us head to a very, very similar situation and obviously a similar result in the Eastern Conference Final. Atlanta United hosting expected favorites. As we talked about last week, Rachel, similarly to you, wanting a surprise from the Seattle Sounders, I predicted, or I said that whether or not Toronto had a chance in this game was dependent upon the health of one Jozy Altidore and one Omar Gonzalez. Jozy Altidore made the trip down with a team from Atlanta. Not sure what happened with his MRI or where he was from a fitness or percentage health standpoint, but in any case, he was not in the 18. It was Alejandro Pozuelo was the false nine up top in a 4-3-3 that morphed into a few different things depending on what the scoreline was. And then Omar Gonzalez was on the bench. Expectations was is that maybe he would have come in to then have Greg Vanney's team switch to their 3-5-2 in between Mavinga and Saman, and then obviously have the fullbacks shift up. Ultimately, Omar Gonzalez did not sub in, and interestingly and very in a risky way for me, Greg Vanney made all three of his regular time substitutions by the 68th minute. So then if they were going to get another opportunity to change somebody, it was going to have to wait till 20 minutes later, plus stoppage time. And then it was going to have to be dependent upon them getting to extra time and then having one extra time sub. Chris Mavinga went down maybe 5-10 minutes within Patrick Mullins being the final sub. So who knows, Toronto almost had to play, you know, down a man just because they had used all their substitutions. But in any case, Atlanta comes out, they're flying. Julian Gressel scores off of a really great, rather direct play off of PT Martinez, setting him up for a tap-in in the fourth minute. Nicolas Menezé scores in the 14th minute off of a long ball from Lorenz Simon with a beautiful curler. Just a couple of minutes before that, there was a PK drawn, I believe, by Pizzi Martinez on Michael Bradley. I might be misremembering which Martinez did it. In any case, Jose Martinez comes up to take the PK. Fun little stat here, Rachel. Every single PK that Jose Martinez missed in 2019 was off of him doing his traditional kind of run-up and then bunny hop before the shot. You know what I'm talking about, listeners, if you've seen it before. And he decided not to do that. He didn't hit it well. He didn't hit it very far away from Quinton Westberg. And Westberg just dives to his right, makes the save, and ultimately Toronto's able to clear their lines. A couple minutes later, Benazee ties it up. And then at that point, it was a lot of possession with absolutely no purpose from Atlanta United. A lot of shots kind of in and around the box and some good emergency defending from Toronto, but, you know, Toronto got stuck in. They had only about 40% of the ball. Atlanta outshot them 19-4, but you didn't really have a whole lot of finishing chances, a lot of missed opportunities for Justin Martinez, and a lot of scoring opportunities for players you wouldn't think to be the goal scorers, or ones in which you, like, if you had to choose between who's getting the shots up, these are not the players. LGP had three chances, Jonathan Yagbe had two, you had one from Jeff Larenowitz, and then ultimately it was just kind of, it was going to come down to somebody having a really good quality moment, and then having a moment of brilliance. We probably would have expected that from Joseph Martinez, maybe Ezequiel Barco or PT Martinez, maybe Alejandro Pozuelo. I don't think, Rachel, that standing here a week later, you know, the week before, you or I would have bet any money on Nick De Leon coming off onto this game as a sub and then ultimately scoring in the 78th minute. But that's exactly what happened, folks. Similar to the Seattle goals, completely against the run of play. Very slowly, they get the ball up to the top of the box. Nick De Leon had subbed in a couple of minutes before. He comes in, gets the ball right at the top of the box, takes his time, and then just spins around and delivers an absolute strike, upper 90. Nothing Brad Guzan could have done. Just a lightning bolt moment of brilliance, completely out of Nick De Leon's you-know-what. At that point, Toronto's up two goals, up a goal. Atlanta's probably completely panicking. They had a couple opportunities, but ultimately flubbed them and were clearly the more flustered team. Toronto got stuck in. Toronto got a result, not unlike Seattle Sounders, and for the third time in 4 years, Rachel, we are looking at the Reds against Rave Green. What do you make of this Eastern Conference final?
I think, you know, like you said, Nick De Leon was not really the person we expected to come out and just absolutely smash a golzo, but I mean, he is one of those guys who's been here, done it before, so he's somebody that you rely on, and I think that that Greg Vanney did well with his subs, although I agree with you, the timing was a little off on them. I think it was an interesting choice, but I mean, hey, they're in the finals for a reason. But I think that, you know, Toronto keep proving that, you know, they don't need their big name stars to win. I mean, obviously it's nice to have reinforcements like Jozy Altidore and Omar Gonzalez, but they're showing that they don't need those guys entirely to win. And honestly, at the way they're playing, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Don't throw guys in there who haven't had the consistency with the first group that, you know, guys starting in their place have. But I think that, you know, Atlanta, it's not a fail. This means, you know, making it back to the final 2 years in a row is not an easy task. Seattle and Toronto can tell you that. They did it before in 2016 and 2017. But I think Atlanta just, they surprised people by even making the playoffs, because everyone was calling for Frank DeBoer's head, maybe in like April or May, and honestly early June. But then they turned it around, turned the ship, got back to winning and getting guys healthy and getting guys into the groove, like Pity Martinez, who a lot of people at first were like, why did we do this? Why did we do this signing? And then as soon as he got comfortable into the system, a couple tweaks were made, you know, they were able to get production out of him. And that's what matters. And I think, you know, getting these pieces of the puzzle together and getting them to gel together is working for Atlanta. You know, obviously Michael Parkhurst is going to be retiring. He's going to be gone. So you got to fill that role. But I think that, you know, Atlanta going out in the conference final isn't a loss by any means. Of course, they want to go back to another final, but they're in good position to build off what they did this year and go for it again next year.
Well said, Rachel. You know, I think we can draw a lot of parallels between these two games, you know, in terms of not ideal situations that Seattle and Brian Spencer had to deal with, and certainly with Greg Vanney and Toronto FC not having their most important attacking player, I would argue their most important defensive player combined, have played 0 minutes and 0 seconds in these playoffs, and they've kind of done just enough. You know, it's a survive and advance theme, and every single game is different, and ultimately both managers have just approached it from, what do I need to do to win this game? And I think it's a very telling lesson that I think can be learned from what these two teams have done to have success in league play, in the playoffs, in their respective Champions League runs. And I would say, you know, it's kind of hard to come. It's difficult to compare the Canadian Championship with U.S. Open Cup, but ultimately in terms of them being pragmatic in a domestic cup-based competition. That it's not about style points, it's simply who are we playing, how do we win this individual moment such that when it's full time, we have one more goal than the opponent has. So we talked about how Seattle wasn't really convincing in their game against FC Dallas. RSL was a little bit of a better matchup, but you know there were three or four things that they absolutely had to get right. And if they did it right, they were going to have an opportunity to beat LAFC. They did those three or four things right, and ultimately they beat LAFC. And I would say the same thing of Toronto FC. And I think both of those managers, given the season that they've had, given the circumstances, their issues at center back, lack of availability of some players up top, whether it's been Jordan Morris and his various injuries and other things that have been going on, and certainly with Toronto and, you know, kind of every single game of, well, Josie's ready for something, and that something is not being in the 18. These two guys have taken the sourest, you know, slimiest, you know, most rotten lemons and turned out a really, really good lemonade product. And that's way more than Bob Bradley got out of his super ripe lemons and I don't, whatever the optimal things are for a lemonade stand. I haven't done a lemonade stand in like 15 years, so I don't know, Rachel. And the same thing for Frank DeBoer in Atlanta. And in that, well, it might not be an exciting final. Well, it's repetitive for a lot of people who don't like either of these teams. Well, it could be extremely ugly in terms of both teams coming out. Let's just do what we have to do to win, even if it's not pretty soccer and nobody's getting style points. Once again, they're absolutely deserving. And in a game in which Atlanta got a little bit unlucky and Joseph Martinez didn't really look good, you were looking for just an opportunity for a mistake or one team to be extremely ruthless with the opportunities they got. We saw that from Nicolas Benazet. We saw that from Nick DeLeon. And similar to Seattle, Toronto FC are absolutely deserving winners of the Eastern Conference playoffs. Any other thing that we want to say about the playoffs to date, Rachel? Or shall we move forward to some of the women's soccer stuff that you have to talk about? And then certainly we'll be talking briefly about the MLS Cup final next weekend as well.
I'm just looking forward to a good match. Seattle already announced that tickets are already sold out, so I think the atmosphere is going to be incredible, and I think Seattle really, truly does deserve a final at home.
Okay, with that, Rachel, what news do you want to, you know, you were messaging a little bit before, you kind of have a few rants to go on as far as the NWSL and U.S. Women's National Team, obviously the new managers in place. Where do you want to start?
Well, the NWSL today just announced some new structure changes to their pay system. They are increasing salaries and they are adding the vacation money mix, and team budgets have increased. I believe roster sizes are still the same, but now teams have $300,000 to spend on players. They have some good takes with allocation money, although I think the rules I was looking for allocation money are extremely limiting and very they're tight, they're very tight rules. But I think that a lot of the new rules really benefit players that aren't those national team players, that are national team players from other countries who deserve the same amount of pay that a U.S. women's national team player gets. So I think that the new rules are exciting. The rules drop the same day that it's reported that Sam Kerr is leaving Chicago and heading over to Europe. Large groan for the NWSL. But honestly, I think for me, I'm happy for Sam. I think she deserves a challenge in Europe. She wants to play Champions League. NWSL, the league got her when she was, you know, a teenager. She was 18 or 19 when she came over here, from Australia and joined the Western New York Flash. So NWSL has gotten a lot of really great years from Kerr and have watched her transform into one of the best players in the world. And competition is picking up over in Europe. So to see her, make the most of it is really exciting. I'm excited to see where she announces, that she's going to be going. I heard the top two are Chelsea, over in England and PSG over in France. But to shift to the U.S. Women's National Team, they're hosting, I almost said Chicago. They're hosting Sweden in a friendly on Thursday, and then they will be hosting down in Jacksonville, Costa Rica, another CONCACAF team on November 10th. And Vladko Andonovski has released his roster, and it makes me smile because there's players on the team, on the roster, that haven't gotten call-ups before that finally deserve it. Goalkeeper of the Year just announced today. Aubrey Bledsoe has been an absolute rock for Washington. Even last year when they were in eighth place, she was still putting up big numbers and, you know, making save of the week almost what looked like every other week. So to see her get the call up, especially because, you know, Alyssa Nayer, as great as she was in France, you know, she's not getting any younger. Neither is Adriana French. And Ashlyn Harris, sorry, I'm going to get persecuted on the internet for this, but she's really not that great of a goalkeeper. So I don't think the last place goalkeeper should be called up to the national team, but that's why I'm not a coach, Matt. But it's nice to see a player like Alana Cook get called in, because one of my biggest qualms with Jill Ellis was that unless you were a player like Crystal Dunn or Heather O'Reilly or Alex Morgan and you were in Europe, you didn't get called up. Even though you were performing well, you didn't get called up because you weren't playing in the NWSL. This was one of my biggest qualms with the ignorance to Gina Lewandowski, how she played out of her mind for Bayern Munich for about 6 or 7 years and just never got called up. But now Alana Cook, who's at PSG, finally gets her first call up. Amani Dorsey of Sky Blue FC gets her first call up to kind of shake up the defense. Not a lot of returning names there on defense from the World Cup team, but you do have Abby Dahlkemper, Becky Sabrin, Emily Sana, of course, Casey Short, who loudly got snubbed for Defender of the Years in there, and you know, she was on the NWSL Team of the Month every single month, the first player to do that, so it's a no-brainer to have her on the roster and potentially on the Olympic roster. But one of the players that excites me the most is Lynn Williams. She was kind of cast aside during the end of the Ellis era. So having her get back into the fold, you know, she's one of the leading scorers for North Carolina. And as we talked about last week, North Carolina is so dominant and they just won their second straight NWSL championship. And I think that, you know, championship winners, they deserve a call up or two. So it's really nice to see her back in the fold, but I'm excited about the roster. I think I'm still more excited about the December roster he's going to drop for this Discovery Camp, as he calls it. So I'm really excited to see that more than this one. But I mean, hopefully players getting first caps. I would love to see Bledsoe start. Maybe not against Sweden. I think they're going to give that one to Nayer, but I would love to see her start, get some action against Costa Rica. I think that'd be a really good test for her.
A lot of really good stuff, Rachel. I think one other comment that we have to bring, granted this is kind of us going down into the almost tabloidy standpoint, but you've talked about both on this podcast and in our conversations about Carly Lloyd and some of the statements she's made post World Cup and everything. What future does she have with the women's national team? What direction do you think that should go in? I mean, there's a lot of baggage there. There's a really big question, certainly a lot of veteran experience, but you've kind of commented that, you know, it's just as with the managerial front, there's time for some new blood from a personnel standpoint and a tactical standpoint for the women's national team.
Do you want my opinion on it?
Sure. Yeah, whatever.
She's not still out on the team anymore.
Okay.
I mean, if you're going to say that the worst time of your life was being on a World Cup championship winning team, then you need to go somewhere else. And, you know, I think the door has been open for her to leave for quite some time now, but you know, I do think that there have been times where coaches have said, maybe we need to call these players in just because of their name. When there are performing players in the NWSL, like Lynn Williams, like Ashley Hatch from Washington, who have been producing. And I think that, to me, you know, she always tries to back up these claims by saying, oh, I don't care what anybody thinks, but is the first to block somebody for giving any critique. She'll always say, oh, I'm not trying to attack my, or not trying to blast my teammates, but that's exactly what she's doing. There are players that are better than you, and those players that are better than you are going to start and they're going to get more minutes than you. You can't look at the performance that Megan Rapinoe had in France and say, oh, well, we're going to bench her because Carly Lloyd's angry. She's not getting minutes. I don't think she has a spot on the Olympic roster. And I think, And Vlatko Andonovski kind of touched on this during his press conference, and I thought he said everything right during that press conference. He said, you know, when I do have to make these decisions with these veteran players and start cutting ties, it's not going to be easy, but at the same time, it's what needs to be done. These younger players, these newer players need to come into the program, and he's opening up the player pool to everyone. He said college, international, domestic, whatever. If you're good enough and you're performing, you are going to be called in. And that's what I've wanted to hear now for the last 4 or 5 years, ever since 2015. Because in the men's national team, if you don't perform, you're not getting called in. But in the women's, you're getting called in because of your name.
Unless you're Giassi's artist and you're trapped in it, doesn't matter. But in any case, no, I hear you, Rachel. It's time for some fresh blood, and it is relieving to hear that at least one of the international teams within the U.S. Soccer Federation will be operating more as a meritocracy, and for an opportunity to be progressive and continue to bring in new players that deserve the opportunity and are going to put the team ultimately in a position to be successful in the Olympics and for future tournaments to, you know, in the future. Let us briefly touch on the MLS Cup, which will be this coming Sunday, or I guess a week from Sunday, November 10th. It'll be at 3 p.m. Eastern. It'll be on ABC, so one of the big channels that you have for the United States here, folks. Also on Univision y en Español, and then 2DN, TSN, and TVAS, the various options that you have for our friends north of the border who wanted to watch Toronto FC in this one. I was texting with a few friends, most of whom were Rapids fans, Rachel, and kind of their commentary that it was, oh, it's Seattle and Toronto again. You know, this is like Cavs versus Warriors almost. Not in the sense that like it's uneven or anything, but from the standpoint of it's just the same teams again. It's very, very boring. And I am here. I want to get your perspective on this, but I first want to kind of plant the flag and to say that is not how I feel about this game, Rachel. Chad Marshall is no longer with the Seattle Sounders. Ozzie Alonso is no longer with the Seattle Sounders. If we want to go way back even further, even though he wasn't involved in one of those finals, we can say the same thing of Clint Dempsey as well. There is no Sebastian Giovinco. We have some doubts about Josie Altidore's available. Alejandro Pozuelo is new. Obviously, we're looking at a third final for Toronto FC that will feature potentially a third starting goalkeeper. It was Clint Irwin, and then it was Alex Bono, and then now it's Quinton Westberg. And, you know, potentially no Drew Moore. And even if Drew Moore is able to play, I would figure that Lorenz Simon would be involved in this team. I would figure that Sebastian Aro would be involved in this team, as would Nick De Leon. And potentially the most significant defensive contributor is Omar Gonzalez. The last two times these teams met, Omar Gonzalez was still playing in Mexico. So there are some similarities in terms of, I still think Nico Lodero and Christian Roldan are probably the two most significant kind of bulldoggy stir, you know, be the straw that stirs the drink in the middle for the Seattle Sounders, but Raul Ruiz Diaz is new. Obviously, there's a new attacking pieces, and even though it's the same players, I think Marky Delgado, to a lesser extent, Richie Larea, and certainly a Jonathan Osorio have different and more significant roles with Toronto FC. So there's maybe three or four guys who are kind of similar, but, you know, if, you know, say Cleveland, you know, I would say it's similar to this year's version of the Cleveland Cavaliers, not maybe from a quality standpoint, but if Cleveland and Golden State were to meet in the finals during this current NBA season, would we not be saying the same things about them? Because the personnel have changed, the main faces have changed, maybe the one consistent that you have between all of their finals would be, you know, Kevin Love on one side, and then Steph Curry, pending his availability, I think he just broke his hand, and then obviously Klay Thompson. So there's a couple of key figures, but I think, and these teams and these managers are still doing some of the very similar things, but there's enough new pieces and there's enough concerns and uncertainty, whether it's Roman Torres and his availability, obviously the two players that I've been knocking about for, you know, the last month for Toronto FC, that I think makes this interesting. I still think that similar to the other two finals, there's a very good chance that one or both of these teams come out and becomes very pragmatic to the point where this is a nervy game to watch, but not necessarily free-flowing, you know, creative attacking soccer that's fun to watch. It could be a really cagey final, which I think will be competitive, but maybe similar to what we've seen other than really the weather, because it's not going to be freezing temperatures in Seattle. That was a big word salad. Rachel, where do you want to start in terms of eating this word salad?
Well, I think that one of the things, too, is that it's an entirely new location. And, you know, MLS Cup. Was it both times it was played in Toronto?
Yes, this will be the first. Yeah, so this is Seattle's first time hosting, and obviously since 2009 that did not feature the Seattle Sound, the Clink will be hosting the final.
Yeah, over 69,000 fans I've seen. That's what the number is. It's a completely different atmosphere than BMO Field. It's completely different weather, the whole nine yards. And Seattle at home is really, really good. So I think that, you know, now they're shifting from, okay, we won it in Toronto, we lost in Toronto. What can we do here to start this? To break this tiebreaker, essentially. So I think that there's so many, like, I think you summed it up in your word salad perfectly. There's a lot of what ifs. There's a lot of, okay, here's who's new and whatnot. You know, I was just thinking the other day about the Sounders defense, you know, in their own right, words, Brad Smith, Kim Keehee, and Kelvin Leardham are all veterans in their own right. I think Kim won the Chinese Super League 2 or 3 years ago, so they know what they're doing. Brad Smith is a regular international. Kelvin Leardham's been at a final before, but none of them were there in 2016, but they're still veterans. So to have them in their first MLS final, but have this veteran status, it's going to be interesting to watch. It's going to be interesting to see how Xavier Arriaga does, being a younger player with less experience in his first, not even a full year in Major League Soccer. So I think that, you know, there's so much different components that makes this, you know, different from years before. Rosters are pretty much completely different, but it's still, you know, it's still the same two teams. You're going to get that narrative throughout the whole week and throughout the whole weekend. But I think that there's just so much that makes it not just the same two teams. I don't know if that makes sense. Words.
Yeah, no, we'll sit on that front, Rachel. We're obviously going to do a full preview of MLS Cup for our show next week, folks. So we'll hopefully have some guests maybe from a Sounders and a Reds perspective on that front. But there's maybe just one other topic that I want to touch on, and let's get out of here, Rachel, because it's Friday and we're both completely exhausted. I will take the Toronto FC perspective on this. You will take the Seattle Sounders perspective on this. Both of these teams have had previous success, maybe some letdowns recently in last season, and obviously some turnover, as we talked about, in terms of personnel. So in one way, this is kind of, I don't want to say a reverse, so to speak, but this is them kind of reestablishing themselves within their respective conferences and then potentially within the league as well. Seattle's obviously clinched, you know, because Toronto can't get to Champions League for 2020 via MLS Cup because they didn't win the Amway Canadian Championship. So for Seattle, this would be two MLS Cups. This would be a continuation of winning trophies off of the Siggy Schmidt era, obviously the decade of dominance. You know, the only team, is it 10 years in a row now that they've made the playoffs and they haven't missed the playoffs in their time existing with an MLS? What would winning MLS Cup mean for the Sounders in terms of their legacy, future of the club, Brian Smetzer, you know, being the dork dad manager who doesn't get credit for his tactics or for actually getting results? What would this mean for the Sounders as a club in the MLS 3.0 era to win a second MLS Cup?
Well, I think that, you know, this whole year you've heard so much about the Sounders being this old team and whatnot, and even still with, you know, Chad Marshall not on the team, they're still older guys. There's not many young faces. Xavier Arriaga is probably the youngest starter, along with Roldan and Morris. So, and those are guys who have been in MLS for quite some time now. But I think that, I think that'll show that the veteran approach does work more than just tossing in a bunch of rookies and saying, go for it. But in regard to Schmetzer, I think that in a way he'll always be in Ziggy Schmidt's shadow, but with a win, I think he kind of puts his name in the history books a little bit more than Ziggy probably did.
Well said, and I'll take the Toronto perspective on this. I think it's similar in the sense that, you know, we thought that they had absolutely crashed last year, and there were doubts going into 2019. What was Greg Vanney's future with the club? What was Michael Bradley's future with the club, just given the failure that ultimately happened in 2018. you know, kind of they had gotten within a penalty kick winning CONCACAF Champions League. I think at that point we probably could have used the word dynasty to describe them, at least in MLS and certainly in Canadian soccer. And then 2018 happened, it fell off, and there was kind of a question, well, is Jozy Altidore too old? Obviously, Sebastian Giovinco wanted outside the door, and there was kind of this question of what did this mean for them? They had definitely a crash in 2018 in the way that the Sounders did. Maybe the Sounders weren't the cream of the crop in the Western Conference, but I think we could say they were certainly in that upper echelon. You know, they were the closest ones to LAFC. We could say that for their entire season, certainly finishing second in the Western Conference, and definitely saying that with them defeating the number one seed in LAFC head-to-head in the Western Conference playoffs. And there was kind of a, well, is this the end of the era? Is Toronto going to have to retool? And if they were to win MLS Cup, I think that's confirmation that 2018 was a blip for them via just getting hit by the CONCACAF bug, getting hit by the CCL bug. And so if they win this trophy, then I think that puts them in a great position. Obviously, you know, if rumors are reported based on what the guys at The Athletic have said, if they were to win MLS Cup, that triggers another DP year for Michael Bradley, who I think, regardless of your thoughts about him for the U.S. national team, folks, would still be an extremely competent central midfielder in 2020. I think that locks them down. Maybe one move at center back. Maybe that's just a matter of letting a veteran go and bringing in a young guy and having Omar Gonzalez completely healthy and fit for the start of the season. But they were to win MLS Cup and then continue to tune up and just be ready for that. They are absolutely a threat in 2020 to compete with New York City FC and their uncertainty, to compete with Atlanta United. And so if they were to win MLS Cup, if they were to win another trophy that isn't the Amway Canadian Championship, so we could say, I guess they can't win CCL, so let's say Supporters Shield, another MLS Cup, or maybe move that towards another CCL run in 2021, we're absolutely talking about them as a dynasty. And so let's say one of these teams, Rachel, wins MLS Cup. Let's say another team or both of them potentially win a major trophy, including the Amway Canadian Championship for Toronto in 2020. And then maybe one of them either wins CCL 2020 or 2021. We could make a legitimate argument that at least in MLS 3.0, there have been two simultaneous dynasties, and pending what Atlanta does with Frank DeBoer and everything, we could even say that there's a third one in there, or ones that there wasn't a dynasty because it was three teams constantly butting heads against each other. When the 2016 MLS Cup happened, Alexi Lalas said right before the game that one team wins this, and officially they get their first MLS Cup. They are the super club to beat going into 2017. The other one just gets to further add to their playoff history of mediocrity and ultimately coming up short. Toronto, and just, you know, having all those DPs that ultimately were busts and never actually being able to do things. Seattle being good in the Open Cup, good in the regular season, and then bad in the playoff standpoint. I think this is a chance for both of these teams to cement themselves as, we've won multiple MLS Cups, we are forced to be reckoned with, and then if they were to win another major trophy in 2020, I think officially we can have the D word, as in dynasty, conversation about them in MLS 3.0 era. Rachel, any other thoughts here, or do we want to head to last words? Okay, let's head to last words. Okay, Rachel, where can people find you on Twitter? Do you have any last words?
You can find me on Twitter at Rachel McKerger, 2 A's, not just one. Not really any last words. I'm excited for MLS Cup, and I'm really, really excited to see how a potential new look U.S. national team holds up against Sweden.
Well said, Rachel. The only last word that I'll have, folks, is our intrepid CPL reporter, Thomas Neff, will be at the CPL final for the second leg on Saturday, so check out his work dealing with Calgary FC and Edmonton FC. So check out that. He'll be covering stuff both on his own Twitter and then obviously on Soccer on the Rise, which you can catch on SoundCloud, and at Last Word FC. Follow me on Twitter at LWSpanPollard, LastWordOnSoccer.com, at Last Word FC across all social media platforms. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Just search Last Word Soccer Club Radio or Last Word on Sports. We're both tired. Rachel, let's get out of here. Listeners, we will see you next week. Thank you again to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group or team or just yourself at roughneckscarves.com. Listeners, we'll see you next week.